Welcome to this Frequency Matters podcast. I'm Pat Hindle. I'm here with my co-host, Gary LaRude. Today, we're taking a look at the commercial and military space markets that are undergoing significant changes. To discuss this topic with us, we welcome back Sean Darcy, Director for Aerospace and Defense at Analog Devices. Welcome, Sean.
Hey, thank you, guys. Thanks again for having me on.
Great. So we see there's a lot of news about the high-density communications constellations of late. But the United States and other countries are standing up military space organizations. What new directions do you see them taking in light of the evolving technologies?
Well, let me look at three areas that I think we're going to see that are related a lot to the influence of some of the new disruptors in the market. You know, I think the military is really looking into trying to encourage much faster development. And so this is not just qualifying parts faster, it's actually getting reduced lead times. You know, years ago, you know, back in the late 90s, building a satellite could take 3 to 6 years. You know, now you think about it, it's taken 3 to 6 months. And so I think that's very appealing to them to drive down those type of times. I think a key one, though, that a lot of these new disruptors have driven is getting technology on orbit sooner. And what I mean by that is, again, years ago, the market probably lagged 10 or 15 years because of the qualification time and effort to get components that were, you know, capable to be on orbit for long periods of time. I think now, you know, people really want to see us and others in the industry, when we release a GaN amplifier, they would like, for example, to see the commercial space version of that probably ready in no more than 3 months after the commercial product releases. And I think the military wants that too, because it allows them to put the latest generation of technology on orbit. And probably last, I think, it's not about less cost, but something I think it appeals to them about the commercial space model is that you can create and manufacture higher volumes. So kind of back to the qualification and lead time, one of the other challenges has always been, because of the high touch nature of a lot of the QMLV or Class K or Class H products, you could manufacture very, very high volumes. I think now when you look at commercial space, we're looking at, you know, volumes 50, 60, 70,000 components a month. And I think that also appeals to the military, because now it's a lot easier to put some of these advanced designs on orbit far quicker.
You mentioned GaN. What other technologies are you seeing that are required to support the evolving generation of military satellites over the next decade?
That's an excellent question. You know, I think GaN is where a lot of people are looking, but I think related to that is we need to see a continued drive to the maturity of a lot of the phased array, not just the technology and the designs themselves, but a lot of the core products that go into those. You know, we're seeing a transition between the analog to a hybrid, to a digital, that's going to have to continue. I think also, you know, not directly related to RF and microwave, but something that's very critical is getting, you know, the next generation of IMUs or inertial products on orbit. You know, as we start to see some of these phased array become extremely accurate in their ability to point, and also with concerns about latency, is we can't be sending signals or requests back to the main satellite or the main satellite bus for pointing information just because of the latency and the accuracy. So I think we need that to actually continue to evolve as well. You know, something else I think we really need to see is, this is across probably not just space, but a lot of the market, is we've got to drive much higher in the spectrum. You know, space for many years was a bit immune from some of the pressures of the terrestrial, basically warfare, spectral dominance concerns. You know, now we're actually seeing adversaries going up, as we've seen, as high as 130 gigahertz. So we're going to have to move up there to match them. And then I think, you know, something that is a bit interesting is, what's the next generation of optical interconnects between satellites going to look like? You know, it's not to actually get rid of RF and microwave, but it's, you know, how do we actually take some of the pressure or some of the congestion off the RF and microwave part of the spectrum and moving into optical interconnects. So I think those are probably three or four technologies that we're going to see need to be developed and probably be developed and deployed in the next 3 to 5 years.
So how do you see the requirements for space qualifications and heritage changing in the military area?
So this is probably the one that is going to be the largest change, probably specific to the U.S. military and probably the European military. You know, for years, we actually have been following a set of qualification and performance standards that are either based on military specifications or NASA specifications, some 30 to 40 years old. I think we need to overhaul all those requirements. We're not going to be able to be nimble. We're not going to be able to be fast if we keep sticking to that previous way of doing it. You know, some of these qualification processes do take 36 months at times. You look at people, some of the modern players in, you know, the SpaceX's, the OneWebs, the Amazons, you know, they're looking to qualify and design these parts in months, not years. So I think we're going to see that overhaul of requirements. What I think we would have to do is, if you guys are familiar with the ASTM standards body, you know, and the group there, I think that's one of the things that would be interesting to see us as industry, who are working with a lot of these disruptors, actually drive the set of requirements that we as both industry and the government's concurrence can actually drive these type of, you know, standards and succeed a lot faster than if we actually did a top-down approach.
With all the focus on the disruptive LEO constellations, how does that affect the qualification for geostationary satellites and the medium Earth orbit constellations?
Well, I think the biggest challenge would be is, you know, making sure that there is at least some focus and that there's some capability that remains to support that part of the market. We at ADI, of course, are going to continue to support that. The portfolio goes into those type of satellites, GEO and MEO. A lot of people have always asked if they're going away, is that dead? It's definitely not. These are very expensive assets. They're also assets that need to have an amazing amount of reliability and very long lives, 20, 25 year. I think some of these are designed with 30 year radiation profiles in mind. So I don't expect to see that go away. You know, and also besides them, you're always going to have things like deep space probes, landers, et cetera. They're going to require that. But I think kind of to rephrase what I said, the biggest thing is that some part of the industry will remain to actually support them instead of pivoting completely over to commercial space.
Previously, you mentioned the need for a semiconductor and electronic subsystem market to look at something like the ASTM standard for emerging commercial space market. What exactly do you mean and how is that rolling out?
So ASTM, I think a good example there is, you know, the ASTM group created a whole new category of, you know, private aircraft in essence. And the genesis of something called light sport aircraft, which is, you know, was a whole new set of aircraft that was very much a fly for pleasure, fly for enjoyment. But instead of having basically the European and the United States governments be heavily involved in trying to create this standard, ASTM pulled together industry and they created a standard that A, had the quality, the reliability, but the safety that EASA and the FAA would buy off on. So it's very, very successful. It allows not only fast qualification, but fast changes as well and modifications. So I think that's something we'd want to do across our industry as an example for commercial space. Without that, right now we could be in the Wild West, right, where there is no definition for that. So many of us will, of course, competition is good, but a lot of times it creates a lot of diversity, also can be good. But when you're in there in a situation where you have to have multiple vendors with multiple requirements, especially when it comes to radiation or single event effects, you have a risk of having to design to the least common denominator. So I think having government and maybe some of the large primes and even maybe some of the disruptors charter and drive that type of activity, I think will you know, put us ahead significantly, but also open up that market so that people like the U.S. military can use those benefits as well.
I can see challenges getting all the competitors around a table to agree on, say, just the agenda. Are you optimistic this could happen?
It's always a good point, right? It's a big challenge. We get all of us in the room, right? We're all competitors. I think it's a friendly rivalry, but we all compete very, very hard. It's very good for the industry. I think the competition between us and some of our larger competitors has actually drove some very rapid advances. You know, but that being said, you know, I think you have a focus on enabling basically a common definition. And the way you do that is it allows us to support some commonality, but allow for performance differentiation. You know, if you have a big push from above, I think that helps, but we do have to all agree to come to the table. I think that is where the complexity comes in. Again, you have to figure out a way that if you look at us and others, we're willing to go and agree to that standard, but it allows us to actually show and highlight our differences and our advantages. I think a good thing of that is if you look at us and one of our largest competitors in this space, we are starting to converge on a very common standard. And so I'm not sure we're that far apart in reality.
What advances do you see in phased arrays for on-orbit assets, such as those providing space-borne internet?
Well, let's talk about maybe, I think the first one is there's a large challenge for LEO satellites. One of the biggest challenges, I think you guys know, we spoke about on previous podcasts, is they spend about almost probably 40% of their orbit in what's called eclipse, or the shade of the Earth. And so power has become a significant hurdle in deploying some of these phased arrays in space. You know, related to that too is there is no convection or conduction in space. So everything's radiation. So any lack of efficiency that drives heat creates a thermal issue. But I think there's some interesting solutions. I think we've seen some very good designs that are based on, you know, what we call hybrid phased array. You know, and part of this is things like these time-delayed beam-forming ICs or BFICs, which, you know, have a far better efficiency when it comes to heat, temperature, and power. But also, I think they provide probably 90% of every capability you'd ever want, as opposed, maybe, not maybe as opposed, but contrasting to a digital beam-forming system. So I think that's one thing. I think the other thing that a lot of us are looking at and very interested in is, how do we do better antenna on package, antenna on module? Again, is this is something that as we're driving up into much more complex larger arrays, that this is becoming critical. So it may not be even antenna on package, maybe antenna impregnated into the package. But I think there's a lot of exciting work going there. And I think that's something we're going to have to do, especially as we move to higher parts of the spectrum.
So related to Pat's question, but shifting to the ground, what architecture trends are you seeing for the user terminals, and what do you expect the next generation will look like?
Well, it's interesting. I think some of the terrestrials have the same solution, but a different problem statement driving them. We've seen a lot of press about the pizza box on a stick and some of the other user terminals that are starting to be moved out of the beta test phase into public consumption, basically. I think, though, there's a lot to be said about replicating the same almost exact on-orbit design. But for this one, it's not about power. It's not about thermal. It's about lower cost and less complexity in design. You know, I think for a while, people thought a discrete solution would be significantly cheaper, significantly easier. I don't think that's played out. So, there's a lot of advantage to basically replicating the same system you have on orbit on the ground. And I think, there's also a large cost savings. You can extend, your volumes through your signal chain, et cetera, et cetera. Also, it means less design expertise and less maintenance you have to have. So I can see that there. I think the other one that I think is going to be a big change in the next generation that's kind of exciting is we all know about airborne terminals. And, I think this latest set of LEO constellations is going to drive some pretty rapid adoption of either conformal phased array or flat plate phased array on aircraft. You know, this will remove, I think, a significant part, of course, the drag on aircraft, but removing the mechanically steered antennas really does reduce a maintenance difficulty, you might say, and increase availability. Another thing I think is, we've just been talking about over the last couple of weeks is, you know, what happens now when you get these really small, compact phased arrays to talk to the LEO satellites, they can be integrated on the top of a car. So, you know, that probably can maybe jump that generation of your self-driving driver assists, or more importantly, internet directly to the car if you have two kids in the back seat, for example. So I think those are pretty exciting developments as well.
When we last spoke previously, you talked about the power challenges that satellites are faced with. This constrains many of the RF and microwave designs due to power and thermal, which you have alluded to. Is this something that's getting better? And if so, how and why?
So I think it's getting a lot better. I think we've I talked a little bit about, we figured out how to probably do and optimize some of the hybrid phased array designs, but it doesn't mean there won't be a drive, and sooner or later there will be a deployment of, digital beamforming and direct sampling type of phased arrays. I think the challenge is that much of that power is consumed more by either the FPGA or some pretty beefy processors that either sit next to or very close downstream to the digitizers. I think something we're seeing is people are not just ourselves, but others are very much looking at how much more fabric, how much more capability and processing can you put into the digitizers that, may reduce the size and the power of the FPGA, but the more things that you can do in the digitizer itself, like DPD or even some of the feedback loops, we can simplify the number of FPGAs in a system and actually make that design simpler. So the rest of the power tree becomes a lot more efficient. We talk a lot about GaN products, and but we expect that efficiency to continue. I see those, especially as we move higher in the spectrum. I think that part of the market is leading, and it's greatly improving some of the, not just the products, but actually it's addressing a lot of the challenges, right? One of the big challenges is as we go higher in the spectrum, we move away from up and down converters and things like that. That saves a lot of power. And I think finally, one of the things is that, again, not directly related to RF and microwave, is how do we do a better job of battery management? As people move to more of the, basically lithium-based batteries on orbit, same type of battery packets as on the high-performance cars, is how do we actually do a much better job of being able to not just manage the total power and charging, but manage the load and feed that in things like the duty cycles of the RF signal chain.
So mentioning the power challenges, what changes are you seeing at the semiconductor level that further address those, as well as maybe the complexity challenges for communication systems?
So we spoke about GaN, guys, so I won't talk about that again. I think something that I would like to point out, though, is the need to do a better job of matching power parts and power design to go with RF, especially some of the high-performance RF. A lot of my background is in system design as opposed to components, and it is true. A lot of times we didn't think about really finalizing and tweaking that power design, if we tweaked it at all, until the very end of the development. And a lot of that's fair because we have a lot of matching to do, we have a lot of changing requirements and a lot of testing to do. But I think we could actually see some great improvements by doing a better job of making sure we have power that actually goes with the correct parts and the correct design. I think related to that, and this might be a couple years off, is moving to what I call Lego blocks. But Lego blocks would be something where instead of every single developer, every single RF designer, in all our customers and everything else, trying to optimize a set of signal chains and the power that goes with it. Basically, we do all that work. We do a lot of that focus, and you create these highly optimized power Legos. An example might be is you're basically an antenna back to the digital DMARC. I think that can really, really help some of the power challenges.
So you get to see a lot of the new trends before many other people. What game changers do you see out here in the next few years other than the Legos?
Yeah, Legos are my favorites, as most of you guys know. But let me tell you one that I think a lot of us see this, and I think it's a challenge, but it's something we're going to solve, and it's going to be really, really, it's going to be a great thing when we get there. I think the holy grail right now is software-defined everything, right? I mean, we have software-defined radios, everything is moving in software-defined. But I think we're looking at is basically a lot more software-defined RF. And that may be part of a Lego, maybe part of a signal chain, maybe part of a SIP or a module. And it's not just things like programmable filters, clocks, and like transceivers. I envision us seeing, and there's a lot of push from some of the research agencies and fundings for this, right, is, integrating SIP or modules that actually you can select part of the frequency, you can select the filters, basically select waveform digitization, et cetera, and they're software programmable. Now, it may not mean they may have to be gate programmable or gate controlled. You may have to do certain things to make sure reliability is there. But, you know, these kind of things, if you start thinking about how you mass produce these, instead of, you know, a couple thousand, you start moving into the millions, it drives costs down significantly. But also, you know, as you guys know, RF and microwave experts are becoming very hard to find. You know, this allows us to enable and give this to more of a system engineering level or others where they can actually now just focus on the digital back end. So I think that's really going to be the big game changer we're going to see probably sooner than later.
That sounds really, really cool. Although I'm not necessarily going to worry about RF and microwave people losing their jobs in the next 5 or 10 years, but it'll certainly have an impact. Yep. If we look at a topic you raised earlier about antennas on or in the package, given the fact that there will be hardware and it will probably be moving higher in frequency, what do you see for antenna packaging and other technologies that are used for integration and how they will be used both on orbit and on the ground?
No, definitely a good question. Let me touch on your last comment. I totally agree with you, and I apologize if I may have misspoke, because you're totally right. The thing is us in RF and microwave will always have jobs. There's such a shortage, and we're in such demand that I could see us needing to develop these more enabling technologies. But I think about an antenna and package, you know, it is going to become an enabling technology, right? People really do. We were lucky. We had a call with a couple of vice presidents who are either running electrical engineering or system engineering for some of the big defense primes. And when they ask what they want something that's basically an antenna on one side and it's a gigabit Ethernet on the other. And so I think we've got all that. The part we're actually missing is the antenna and the antenna on package. You know, there's some really interesting technologies, and there's some partners and some pretty good research being done, especially around the area here in Massachusetts, that I think is very, very promising. You think about it, as we move higher in the spectrum, it may not become an option. It may be a necessity to be able to do antenna on package. You know, but that being said, I think the other one we have to really look at is there's some great university and academic work that's been done on this. Where I think industry need to help them accelerate this to be able to mass produce it. I think that's still, you know, one of the challenges is we can do an antenna on package, but can we make a million of them a month? And that's why I think we're still falling short.
Sean, does the space industry benefit from programs like DARPA CHIPS or defense research encouraging integration?
Very much so. So I think, you know, without a ringmaster, you know, competition, I think, drives a lot of divergence. You know, and CHIPS, you know, we've already seen it's about, 4 years in, you know, CHIPS is really driving a lot of integration. Ourselves and most of the people in the industry play in that. I think the other thing is that it's a good collaboration where we're not just integrating between the die and those of us that make the lower level components, but we're actually, you know, raising this up to a lot of the primes and the integrators. So that's a, you know, a huge advantage. And you see this really accelerating the time for integrated systems. You know, DARPA and actually many other government agencies are putting together a lot of research programs. You know, the government now has a bunch of consortiums that we're members, and I think a lot of people are members of. These definitely help. So the more requests and focus we get from people like DARPA, the better. I think CHIPS is a really, really good example of where they put their money in the right place, and it showed very, very good dividends.
Thank you, Sean, for joining us to talk about the space market and the latest trends that you're seeing. You have a great perspective at Analog Devices and bring your own insight to discern the important points, and I always learn a lot from these conversations.
Well, thank you, guys. I always appreciate talking with you.
Well, we appreciate you talking with us and hope to catch up with you again in a few months for an update. Thanks, everyone, for listening today.